content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Lonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the June 29th, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has very high chain link fence. Behind it are standing three Latino boys, just in jeans and T-shirts. The oldest one standing closest to the fence, and he's got his fingers wrapped through the chain link, and they all have sort of questioning, forlorn looks on their faces. The title this week says, "Is This America? Why Trump Backed Down on Child Separation Policy." And I believe that is, in fact, our first main story. Trump backs down on border separations. What happened? Facing a growing wave of national outrage, President Trump this week signed an executive order halting his administration's policy of separating migrant families detained at the southern border. Trump, who had insisted only Congress could fix the problem by changing the law, abruptly reversed course after Congress, religious leaders, many Republicans, and his own wife and daughter expressed dismay over photographs of children kept in chain-link fence enclosures, audio tapes of wailing toddlers, and reports that dozens of infants and toddlers were being sent to, quote, tender age shelters in South Texas. More than 2,300 children were separated from their parents following the Trump administration's implementation in May of a zero-tolerance policy requiring the prosecution of all illegal border crossings. "I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated," the president said, crediting conversations with his wife, Melania, and his daughter, Ivanka, with helping change his mind. But Trump said that zero-tolerance policy would continue. Parents who cross the border or arrive seeking asylum will be charged and detained along with their children. Condemnations of the separation policy poured in from such figures as the typically apolitical former First Lady Laura Bush, who called the policy immoral, a view echoed by former First Ladies Rosalynn Carter, Hillary Clinton, and Michelle Obama, as well as evangelical leader and Trump supporter Franklin Graham, who called the separation of families terrible and disgraceful. For days, Trump and his aides defended the policy, with the president falsely blaming the Democrats and immigration law and insisting in a tweet that his critics want illegal immigrants to pour into and infest our country. What the editorial said: "When did caging kids become the art of the deal?" asked the New York Times. Trump created this vile border mess as a means to pressure congressional lawmakers, including Democrats, into accepting his demand for a harsh new immigration law. The president's preferred House legislation would fund his precious border wall, slash legal immigration by 25%, raise the bar for asylum standards, and consign Dreamers to permanent limbo by requiring them to re-up their status every 3 years. It's sad that jailing children and their parents together in detention centers is now considered progress in the current immigration climate. Team Trump has no one to blame for this crisis but itself, said the New York Post. Children being ripped from their parents' arms doesn't just look terrible, it is terrible. When the U.S. government is earning comparisons to Nazis, it's time to reverse course. While breaking up families is bad, said the Washington Examiner, giving illegal immigrants incentive to drag their children through dangerous networks of human smuggling isn't great either. to create a more orderly, humane immigration process. The administration should send dozens of lawyers and judges to preside over asylum requests and to expedite the deportation of parents and children who are denied entry. It's possible to show compassion while still enforcing the rule of law. What the columnist said, "I don't recognize this country anymore," said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Traumatizing children as a matter of deliberate policy takes a toll not only on those arrested and detained, but also on our own humanity. Let's face it. The only way to rationalize these events is to view these immigrants as less than human. Trump saw the children as hostages, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. He badly wants Congress to fund his border wall and was willing to use the sight of caged children and the sound of their sobs as flesh and blood bargaining chips. Trump's Fox News cheerleaders defended this heartless policy, and polls showed many Republicans did too. But the astonishing cruelty on display here deeply worried Republican elected officials who fear it will fuel a Democratic wave in November. Separating kids and parents may turn out to be a big political mistake. When emotionalism meets scaremongering, it's tough to have substantive debate, said David Harsanyi in The Federalist. Comparing the fenced enclosures used to detain illegal immigrants to Nazi concentration camps is moronically hyperbolic. Yes, a policy that fails to let parents know immediately and continuously exactly what's happening to their children is immoral, but doesn't justify the left's characterization of the U.S. as a budding fascist state. With their extremist rhetoric, both the Trump administration and its liberal critics are creating a political climate that makes immigration impossible to fix. Do you know why Trump caved in, said Windsor Mann in USA Today? It wasn't because his heart was touched. The family separation policy had created a massive furor, and Trump doesn't like policies that divert attention away from him. His goal is always to create drama, which he does by inflaming cultural grievances and sowing distrust among Americans. In that respect, tearing kids from the arms of their parents achieved its goal. And we'll read a second main story today. Markets tumble as trade war heats up. What happened? President Trump escalated a growing trade war with China this week, threatening to levy tariffs on virtually all Chinese products imported to the U.S. unless Beijing makes major trade reforms. Just days after China threatened to impose $50 billion in tariffs on American products, including soybeans, beef, cars, and tobacco, measures that came in response to earlier U.S. tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods, Trump upped the ante, ordering U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer to draw up a list of $200 billion in Chinese products to hit with 10% tariffs. Trump then warned that he would order yet another $200 billion in tariffs if China retaliated. Together, that would total tariffs on $450 billion worth of Chinese goods, a sum nearly as large as the $505 billion in goods China sent the U.S. last year. Wall Street shuddered at the prospect of an all-out trade war. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled nearly 300 points, about 1%. Wiping out all of its gains for the year. The European Union, Mexico, and Canada are also preparing to levy retaliatory tariffs in response to the Trump administration's decision to impose 25% tariffs on foreign steel and 10% on imported aluminum. The EU will impose penalties on $3.2 billion in American goods at the end of this week, with many of the penalties tailored to target Republican voters, including on sweet corn, bourbon, jeans, and motorcycles. Canada, where citizens have been boycotting U.S. products, will likewise impose $12.5 billion in tariffs beginning July 1st. What the columnist said, "Bring on the trade war," said Ned Roan in TheHill.com. "China declared economic war on us years ago by forcing U.S. companies in China to surrender their intellectual property. dumping steel and aluminum at artificially low prices, and propping up state-owned firms. President Trump should do whatever it takes to bring the regime to heel. He should likewise ignore the pearl-clutching from Canada and the EU. America has indulged our so-called allies for too long. America has legitimate grievances with Beijing, said Peter Marucci in FoxNews.com. But China's privateers are stealing European and Canadian intellectual property and jobs, too. We need help putting pressure on China, and slapping tariffs on our friends only pushes them into Beijing's corner. Trump has said that trade wars are easy to win, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. But his supporters in agricultural areas are already bristling at his protectionism. Meanwhile, China's command economy provides Xi Jinping with plenty of tools for insulating his citizens from price increases. So far, Trump has avoided imposing tariffs on most consumer goods, said David Fickling in Bloomberg.com, hoping to avoid political backlash. But it's impossible for him to hurt China much more without cutting into categories like clothing, homewares, and electronics. Prices for washing machines in the U.S. have already risen 17% since a separate set of tariffs was imposed in January. It may well be that the White House's latest threat is no more than a gambit. America's consumers had better hope so. Our controversy of the week, Trump. Has the GOP become a personality cult? The proof keeps pouring in, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. The Republican Party is devolving at an accelerating speed into a cult of Donald Trump. In Tuesday's primaries, at Trump's last-minute urging, GOP voters rejected South Carolina Representative Mark Stanford, a veteran conservative deemed insufficiently loyal to the president. And in Virginia, they nominated Corey Stewart, a far-right white nationalist whose rabid devotion to President Trump outstrips even his love of the Confederacy. The Trump propagandists over at Fox News, meanwhile, have been plumbing new depths of Orwellian dishonesty in the service of the dear leader. Not only do Fox anchors daily echo the president's baseless conspiracy theories about the deep state and Bob Mueller's witch hunt, but the network this week even attacked GOP Senator Marco Rubio for the heresy of criticizing North Korea's Kim Jong-un, the vicious dictator upon whom Trump is suddenly lavishing praise. Republican voters simply shrug off blunders and scandals that would have doomed prior presidents, said David Weigel in WashingtonPost.com. As Republican Senator Bob Corker put it, it's becoming a cultish thing, isn't it? It sure is. With a staggering 90% of Republicans now approving of the president's job performance, one of our major political parties is now united not by fealty to ideas or politics, but to a man. Is that really so unprecedented? Asked Eric Erickson in BostonHerald.com. The cult of personality around Trump looks an awful lot like the one worshipful Democrats created during the Obama years. I don't share my fellow conservatives' admiration for Trump, but unfortunately, progressives have driven many red state Americans into Trump's arms with their extremism on guns and abortion and their contempt for traditional Christians. Why wouldn't Republicans rally around Trump? Asked Rory Cooper in the DailyBeast.com. He may be erratic and undignified, but his agenda is still conservative, co-opted from the Republican playbook to a large degree, and not the other way around. He's consistently pro-life, pro-business, pro-military, and pro-Second Amendment. It would be foolish for elected Republicans to blow up their whole careers by assailing Trump rather than supporting a president who is fulfilling long-held Republican policy goals. Despite some overlap, Trumpism isn't really conservatism, said Jay Bookman in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Republicans used to stand for free trade, family values, fiscal conservatism, limited government, and strong international leadership. Today, the principles of the Trump Party are defined by whatever it is that Trump tweets next. That may be true for the large mass of low-information voters who rally around Trump out of group solidarity, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. But there are plenty of Republicans who still cherish conservative principle and ideology. While they're silent now, they will eventually make their voices heard. It may already be too late, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. Trump has a cult leader's talent for reshaping reality to conform to his delusions, which he insists upon with extraordinary energy and stamina. Many Republicans have simply lost interest in the ideas and principles that our politics used to be about, and have joined Trump in his ludicrous reality show, where the truth is whatever he says it is. They're for whatever he's for, even if that means changing their minds on a dime. Among Republicans, at least, Trump's strength is growing. The more people who call the emperor clothed, the harder it is to see him naked. Well, let's see what we've got in our good week, bad week segment. Seems that it was a good week for goosebumps. After 2,505 women set a new world record for the largest skinny dip by bathing in the nude off the east coast of Ireland to raise funds for cancer research. I have never been naked in front of anybody before except my husband, and it was brilliant and bracing, said participant Deidre Betson. It was a good week for earth-shaking enthusiasm. After seismologists detected a small earthquake in Mexico City, at the same time Mexico scored in the team's 1-0 World Cup victory over Germany. The artificial quake was probably caused by mass jumping, geologists said. And it was a good week for Kim Jong-un, who in the wake of the recent summit with President Trump now boasts a higher favorable rating among Republicans, 19%, than does House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, 17%. But it was a bad week for interactivity after a 5-year-old boy accidentally knocked over a sculpture titled Aphrodite de Kansas City at a community center in Kansas. The center's insurers have billed his parents for $132,000. It was a bad week for calling 911 after a 12-year-old Canadian boy did just that, twice, to complain about being forced to eat a salad. Corporal Dal Hutchinson of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police told the boy not to make non-emergency 911 calls, but added sympathetically, many of us can relate to the dislike of a salad at times. And it was a bad week for sloths after a report that defecation for sloths can be as painful as childbirth is for human females. Adult sloths move their bowels only once a week, said Pittsburgh zookeeper Kathy Schlott. And when the floodgates open, it's a big production. And before we leave the page, a boring but important item. Budget deficit up 23%. the federal budget deficit ballooned 23% during the first 8 months of the fiscal year, according to the Treasury Department, with the government taking in less money from corporate taxes while also ramping up spending. Corporate tax revenue decreased 25%, while spending increased on military programs, Homeland Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The difference between what the government spent and what it took in totaled $532.24 billion in October through May, compared with $432.85 billion during the same period a year earlier. The Congressional Budget Office expects the deficit to grow more as spending continues to outpace revenue. Government revenue fell 10% in May compared with a year earlier, spending 11%. Article on the briefing page this week is titled Iraq's Fledgling Democracy. Iraq is again struggling to form a new government. 15 years after the U.S.-led invasion, has democracy taken root? What is daily life like? There are distinct signs of progress. Downtown Baghdad is bustling, and violence in the capital is at its lowest level in nearly a decade. Reconstruction of Iraq's cities and towns is now joining oil production as one of the biggest drivers of the economy. In Mosul, which was under the brutal control of ISIS for several years until the militant group was defeated last summer, women have shed their Islamist-imposed burqas, and they now freely mingle and bargain with men in the marketplaces. But 15 years of war, sectarian violence, terrorism, and poor leadership have left deep scars on Iraq and its population of 37.2 million people. Corruption is rampant. Nearly a quarter of Iraqis are in poverty, and 10% remain displaced from their homes. In Ramadi, thousands of people live in tents next to the rubble of their houses. Many Iraqis are dispirited, angry, and deeply cynical about the government. Think of the young man sitting around with no money, no home, and no job, said Regional Governor Ibrahim al-Janabi. It seems impossible he's not going to start looking for someone to blame. Turnout in the May 12th election was just 44%, the lowest it has been in the four elections since 2003. Who won that election? Politics in Iraq is fragmented. Nearly 7,000 candidates from 87 parties ran for 329 seats in the parliament, but it still produced a clear winner, Muqtada al-Sadr, the firebrand cleric who once led the Shiites' Mahdi army against U.S. coalition forces. Formerly close to Iran, he has repositioned himself as a nationalist who wants to rid Iraq both of Iranian and U.S. meddling. His Sirun bloc, which took 54 seats, includes secular communists and Sunnis. Sadr didn't run personally, so he won't be a prime minister, but he is acting as a power broker. Second place went to the Fatih Alliance of Hadi al-Amiri, a Shiite militant whose Badr organization has strong ties to Iran. He actually fought on the side of Iran during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. Amiri's party got 47 seats and wants an alliance with religious parties. Outgoing Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, whose secular victory alliance came in third with 42 seats, is scrambling to retain any power. The recount, expected to take months, is in crisis, thanks to a fire in a Baghdad warehouse containing 1 million ballots. Most of the paper ballots were spared, but the equipment to count them was destroyed, and Sadr said his opponents were trying to subvert his victory. Certain parties are trying to drag Iraq into a civil war, he said. Why aren't there new leaders? There are plenty of new women lawmakers, thanks to a 25% quota in the parliament, But militants and clerics have dominated Iraq's politics since the 2003 toppling of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. The underpinnings of a democratic society are still in their infancy there, so secular moderates haven't been able to create strong political movements. In places like Mosul, said Chatham House analyst Renaud Mansour, the same leaders who abetted political dysfunction before ISIS took over the city are likely to govern again. One-third of all employed Iraqis work for the government bureaucracies and can dole out various perks on their own clan to their own clans. That's why, says analyst Hussein Ibish, all the parties will try to join whatever government emerges, since it's hard to put your hand in the cookie jar if you're standing outside the kitchen sulking. What about the Kurds? Iraqi Kurds had huge setbacks last year. Their September referendum on independence for the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region produced a resounding win for the pro-independence movement. But the vote was held against the wishes of both the Iraqi government and the Kurds' foreign allies, including the U.S., and it lost them significant political clout within Iraq and goodwill abroad. The following month, Iraqi forces seized control of the city with Kirkuk and surrounding oil fields, leaving Iraqi Kurdistan with none of the territory it had won since 2003. In the May election, the two largest Kurdish parties, the KDP and the PUK, won a combined total of just 43 seats, leaving them with little leverage. Some frustrated Kurds want to revolt against Baghdad, while others have sunk into political apathy. How long will U.S. troops stay? It's open-ended. The Pentagon says about 5,200 American troops are serving there, but military records show as many as 9,000 U.S. troops are currently assisting and training the Iraqi army in counterterrorism, border security, and policing. Sadr, who is now playing kingmaker to the next government, is promoting an Iraq-first message and wants all foreign troops out. His vision of Iraq would see independent technocrats, rather than politicians, run government ministries. The goal is to end the sectarian patronage system that has kept Iraq so divided and so corrupt. But nearly every political faction still has its own armed militia. So peace is precarious. It's still too early, says Iraqi political scientist Harith Hassan al-Karai, to celebrate an Iraqi democracy. And it's time to read a few of the best columns of the week. This first comes from the U.S., titled, North Korea's Bribery Diplomacy. Let the bribery begin, said Isaac Stonefish. Now that the Singapore summit is over, Kim Jong-un will undoubtedly seek a high price for his vague promises to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. The canny tyrant will demand not only sanctions relief and international legitimacy from an overeager President Trump, but direct transfers of cash. This is historically how North Korea does diplomacy. Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, successfully extracted bribes in the hundreds of millions of dollars, as well as thousands of tons of rice, corn, and chemical fertilizers, all just as a precondition for meeting with South Korean presidents in 2000 and 2007, when South Korea balked at the elder Kim's demand for $10 billion in aid in 2009. Pyongyang responded by sinking a South Korean military vessel, killing 46, and bringing the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war. Foolishly, Trump is claiming his meeting with Kim ended the North Korean nuclear threat, giving Kim all the leverage in future negotiations. If Kim wants a cash injection, he can privately threaten to humiliate Trump with a few ICBM tests. Trump can then either publicly admit he was all wrong about Kim or pay up. This is a European column from Ireland. Time to scrap the ban on blasphemy. Buoyed by high turnout for the recent referendum on legalizing abortion, Ireland's government is now turning its sights on another clause in our Constitution, the ban on blasphemy, said the Irish Times. A referendum on the issue, scheduled for October, is long overdue. Ireland's Law Reform Commission recommended in 1991 that the now eight-decade-old prohibition be scrapped. So did the 2013 Constitutional Convention. But the rarely used blasphemy clause seemed trivial until 2015, when British comedian Stephen Fry appeared on an Irish TV program about the meaning of life and said God was stupid, selfish, and quite clearly a maniac. A single viewer in County Clare was offended and reported Fry to the police, and much time and money were wasted in an official investigation that ultimately resulted in a decision not to prosecute for lack of an injured party. Of course, we shouldn't allow a free-for-all of religious defamation. The constitutional ban can be replaced by a simple law barring incitement to religious hatred. And while we're at it, the referendum should also ask the Irish to remove a constitutional clause that suggests a woman's place is in the home. Let Irish law reflect the modern world. And this from Japan. Will young people give up the kimono? A new law lowering the legal age of adulthood from 20 years old to 18 could have the unintended consequence of killing off the ailing kimono industry, said Tomohiro Osaki. The change was made to encourage Japanese young people to take their place in a graying society a bit faster. At 18, they can now get credit cards and marry without their parents' consent, though they will still have to wait until their 20th birthday to legally drink, smoke, and gamble. But if kids become adults at 18, the coming-of-age ceremony, which cities typically hold in January, will occur when they are third-year high school students, who are also gearing up for college entrance exams only a few weeks away. Shopkeepers fear that young women will be too busy to worry about choosing a kimono for the event. The traditional attire can cost thousands of dollars to rent, and some people no longer wear a kimono even for their wedding. The coming-of-age ceremony is something of a final stronghold for our industry survival, said Hidemitsu Miyamoto of the clothier Kimono Kurudo Miyamoto. Lowering the age of adulthood could be a huge blow. Of course, many Japanese youth might choose to hold their ceremonies at age 20, so they can celebrate adulthood with that first legal cocktail. And on to the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, How to Survive a Nuclear Attack. Most Americans have no idea what to do if a nuclear bomb detonates where they live or in a nearby city, said journalist Gordon Sander. One group of experts is trying to change our lack of preparedness. Let's say it's 2 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon and you receive an emergency alert on your cell phone indicating that there has been a nuclear explosion in the next town or that an intercontinental ballistic missile is headed your way. Would you know what to do? Most likely not. I would say that the United States is probably less prepared for any kind of nuclear detonation than it has been at any time since the Cold War, said Alex Wellerstein, a historian of science and technology at Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. And that is a dangerous place to be. Wellerstein, along with Kristen Carl, a political psychology professor at Stevens, is pushing for the U.S. to bring back civil defense, the all but forgotten Cold War era federal program for preparing and responding to a nuclear event. Exactly what a revamped 21st century version of civil defense might look like and sound like is the objective of a new project they are directing called Reinventing Civil Defense. Started in 2016 and funded by the Carnegie Foundation, RCD boasts a diverse, high-powered advisory group that includes everyone from former Secretary of Defense William Perry to nuclear health physicists to screenwriters. The mission? Tell you what to do in the event of a nuclear crisis. Most Americans, particularly younger ones who did not live through the most dangerous days of the Cold War, have no practical or conceptual idea of how to respond to the warning of an actual nuclear emergency. Witness the scenes of mass panic that took place in Hawaii last January after what turned out to be a false alert about the imminent North Korean attack. Colin Wellerstein, along with many other experts, lay much of the blame for this alarming nuclear unpreparedness on the federal government and its failure to communicate how to prepare for such an eventuality. The government has given Americans no good sense of what, specifically, to do when the next nuclear crisis occurs, said Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. To be sure, this is not an easy task. The original version of civil defense, also known as duck and cover after its famed guidance to school children to protect themselves from a nuclear attack by ducking under their school desks when they saw a telltale flash outside, is often remembered as silly and misleading, particularly the impression it gave about how easy it would be to survive a full-scale nuclear war. But Wellerstein and Carl feel that a lot about the original, oft-mocked program was constructive and worth resurrecting, particularly the fact that, at the very least, it did get Americans to think about the unthinkable. There are at least three different types of credible nuclear threats that exist today, two more than during the Dr. Strangelove days. Scenario one is the fear that set the original civil defense program in motion, an apocalyptic exchange between the U.S. and Russia or China involving hundreds of thermonuclear weapons. The U.S. population would theoretically have a 20 to 30 minute warning before the multi-megaton bombs began bursting in air, spreading radioactive fallout in overlapping lethal circles, and the lights started going out for good. Scenario two is the nuclear terrorist scenario, i.e., the detonation of a smaller 10 kiloton device in a major American city. Those fortunate enough not to be among the tens of thousands killed during the initial blast would have a short time to protect themselves from the subsequent fallout. Scenario three is the North Korea scenario, involving the airburst of a 100 or 150 kiloton device over an American city, perhaps Los Angeles, with hopefully a 30-minute warning. The result would range from an estimated 195,000 to 241,000 deaths and 510,000 to 629,000 injuries from both the blast and radioactive fallout, depending on the bomb's yield. Scenarios 2 and 3 are the most likely, and also the ones that the RCD researchers are focused on, for the moment at least. They are also survivable if you and emergency management officials know how to respond. But RCD's first challenge is how to untangle the star-crossed history of the first version of civil defense, says Wellerstein. It all began with Bert the Turtle, the smiling, helmet-adorned mascot of the first, much-derided civil defense program, which was run by the Federal Civil Defense Administration. This is the ancestor of FEMA. Bert is the star of a famous 1951 instructional cartoon called Duck and Cover. Bert the Turtle walks down the road, goes the chorus in the famed song, as our smiling hero confidently sashays down the road in the cartoon. And Bert the Turtle was very alert. When dangers threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. The reason Bert and his fellow Americans knew what to do was that they were familiar with the instructions in the upbeat government pamphlet, Survival under Atomic Attack. You can live through an atom bomb raid, and you don't need a Geiger counter or special training to do it, the leaflet fatuously advised. You should hide underground if there is time. Otherwise, you should jump into the nearest gutter or ditch. And don't forget to shut the window. Since then, the issue and practice of civil defense has waxed and waned with the rise and fall of international tensions over the following decades, along with the evolving outlook and experiences of the chief occupants of the White House. President John F. Kennedy, who took office at the start of the second tensest decade of the Cold War, was a big booster of civil defense. He announced the federal government would initiate a $700 million nationwide fallout shelter plan, while also encouraging Americans to build their own fallout shelters. Kennedy's brother Robert even pressed for a scheme that would require all American citizens to practice evacuation and shelter drills once a week. Eventually, Kennedy's interest in civil defense waned as he became convinced of the impracticality of a nationwide shelter program, as well as the unwinnability of a nuclear war. As Harvard economist and key Kennedy advisor John Kenneth Galbraith wrote in a personal letter to the president, those Americans who did manage to survive a nuclear exchange would emerge into a desolate world with no food, no transportation, and full of stinking corpses. So did the skeptical Congress, which whittled JFK's request for $700 million down to a mere $80 million. Jimmy Carter tried to inject new life into the civil defense program by creating the Federal Emergency Management Agency in 1979. FEMA consolidated the work of several agencies into one, mixing nuclear preparedness with preparedness for floods, tornadoes, and earthquakes. But the nuclear issue took a back seat. Ronald Reagan, who came into office convinced that the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal had overtaken that of the U.S., conflated civil defense with the national defense. Toward that end, in 1982, the Reagan administration proposed a comprehensive civil defense program costing $4.2 billion. However, Reagan, like Kennedy, lost interest in the program once he became convinced the nuclear war was unwinnable and unsurvivable. You might be surprised to hear that Uncle Sam has a cogent message about what the public should do in case of a nuclear attack. The advice is basically a revised version of duck and cover. Get inside, stay tuned. Broken down, that means once you receive a warning or alert of nuclear detonation, you should get inside the nearest building or other standing, preferably concrete structure, stay there for at least 12 to 24 hours, the period when the outdoor fallout radiation level is most dangerous, and wait for further news from emergency management officials about which areas downwind from the blast are safest to evacuate next. One of the chief progenitors of that advice is Brooke Budenmeyer, a certified health physicist at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in California. Budenmeyer, who has been on the staff of Livermore since 1989, is also on the advisory board of Reinventing Civil Defense. Budenmeyer concedes that until recently, he and his colleagues were focused on what would happen and how the public should respond to a Scenario 2 level event, a terrorist attack. But he points out that the same slogan would also apply for a Scenario 3 level event. So, where are these recommendations? Why haven't we seen them? It turns out that they are located on page 66 of a 130-page document compiled by a federal interagency committee in 2010 known as Planning Guidance for Response to a Nuclear Detonation. It reads, "The best initial action following a nuclear explosion is to take shelter in the nearest and most protected building or structure and listen for instructions from authorities." Former Secretary of Defense William Perry says he has mixed feelings about civil defense. He was one of the participants in the Preventive Defense Project, a group of leading government officials, scientists, and policy experts who convened in Washington in 2007, 5 years after the 9/11 attacks, to answer the then much more urgent question, on the day after a nuclear weapon goes off in a U.S. city, what will we wish we'd have done to prevent it? Perry co-authored the resulting report, entitled The Day After, Action Following a Nuclear Blast in a U.S. City. The document called the federal government to account for not yet coming up with a realistic contingency plan for dealing with the aftermath of a nuclear terrorist incident. Remarkably, such a plan does not yet exist, wrote the authors, who also included future Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter, although they added hopefully, it is being drafted. Perry and others also recommended a new type of fallout shelter program supplied with stocks of food, water, and other supplies for several days, somewhere along the lines of the thousands of shelters with which civil defense-minded Switzerland has equipped its towns and cities, as well as a computer modeling system for rapidly measuring radiation to enable both emergency workers and the public to determine the safest zones downwind from the blast. 10 years later, as Perry notes, it is questionable whether these measures have been taken. The government does have a rapid radiation modeling capability, but there has been little movement on the national fallout shelter system idea. So what sorts of things is RCD doing? For one, there's Drawing Doomsday, using comics for civil defense, a graphic novel project designed to apply the tools of visual storytelling to a reinvented civil defense. There's also Nuclear Warriors, Stories from a Nuclear World, a podcast and network for communicating stories relating to nuclear risk and salience among the public. And then there's the darker Mark 17 User's Manual, a graphic fictional operation and maintenance guide to the first 15 kiloton 1957 model hydrogen bomb. Times have changed, and the way we communicate with each other has changed, too, says Carl. As far as the advice about how your family can survive a nuclear detonation, Wellerstein would prefer to alter Buddemeyer's message. If I had my druthers, I would change the can in your family can survive a nuclear detonation to might survive. I think any communication about nuclear attacks needs to emphasize that the number of dead would be staggering, even with perfect execution of civil defense procedures. Wellerstein also thinks that the stay tuned part of Buddemeyer's mantra might be too hopeful. Will people have telephones or the internet after a nuclear detonation? I don't know. He adds, I'm not sure that the government can communicate on this as openly as they ought to. The basic problem, Buddemeyer and Wellerstein agree, is that the message isn't really getting out there at all. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico magazine. Here are a couple of health and science short articles for you. The first titled, Hurricanes Get Slower, Deadlier. Hurricanes and typhoons are crawling across the planet at a slower pace, amplifying the devastation they cause when they make landfall, new research shows. A scientist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration found a 10% slowdown in tropical cyclones around the world between 1949 and 2016. That trend is even more dramatic in the North Atlantic, where hurricanes slowed by 20% over land. Slow-moving storms rain more over a given area and pummel that area for longer with their winds, as Houston discovered last year with Hurricane Harvey, which dropped nearly 50 inches of rain over 4 days. Every one of the hazards that we know tropical cyclones carry with them, all of them are just going to stick around longer. study author James Cawson tells the Washington Post. Cawson believes the slowdown is likely the result of climate change. As the planet warms, the difference in temperature and atmospheric pressure between the poles and the tropics is reduced, which slows the wind currents that carry tropical storms. Meds tied to depression. As the U.S. suicide rate ticks up, a new study has found that more than a third of Americans are taking at least one prescription drug that could raise their risk of depression. Researchers analyzed medications taken by 26,000 adults from 2005 to 2014 and identified more than 200 widely used drugs that list depression or suicidal thoughts as possible side effects, including hormonal birth control pills, antacids like Prilosec and Zantac, beta blockers, and the anti-anxiety pill Xanax. About 37% of people took at least one of the drugs, and researchers discovered that the more these drugs participants used at the same time, the greater their likelihood of depression. Some 15% of people who used three or more of the drugs but didn't take an antidepressant had depression, while only 7% of those taking one and 5% of those who weren't taking any had the condition. Columbia University psychiatrist Philip Muskin tells the New York Times that he can't say whether the widespread use of these drugs is contributing to the rising suicide rate, but adds, could it play a role? The honest answer is yes. And we'll just move right on over to the Talking Points page. Here's an article. Trump Foundation. Sloppy or illegal? It's now official. The Trump Foundation is basically a scam, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. A lawsuit filed by the New York State Attorney General's office accuses the charitable nonprofit of being an empty shell that has engaged in persistently illegal conduct. Among the alleged transgressions are the use of $100,000 in charitable funds to settle a lawsuit against Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort, $264,000 to renovate a fountain outside Trump Plaza Hotel, $30,000 for two portraits of Trump, and, believe it or not, $7 to cover the billionaire's son's Boy Scout registration fee. Emails show that $2.8 million raised by the Foundation for Military Veterans in 2016 was handed over to then-campaign manager Corey Lewandowski for dispersal, which the suit calls an illegal in-kind contribution to the campaign. Trump's violations of laws governing charities are almost too buffoonishly sloppy to be believed, said Francis Wilkinson in Bloomberg.com. Just imagine what Special Counsel Robert Mueller is finding as he digs into Trump's shady finances and secretive dealings with Russia. The moral of this story is that the Donald J. Trump Foundation was a bad idea, said Peter Riley in Forbes.com. The foundation's board, consisting mostly of Trump's older children, Donald Jr., Ivanka, and Eric, hasn't met since 1999. That means the charitable organization was little more than a checkbook that Trump could sign at will, with no skilled oversight or legal advice. Most of the money did go to legitimate charities, and this mess could have been avoided if the Trump kids and their CFO had sat down for an hour every year and had some minutes of their deliberation typed up. Trump's self-dealing was ugly, but that's a civil transgression, not a criminal one, said The Economist in an editorial. It's hard to imagine violations of charity law will clear the bar of impeachable high crimes and misdemeanors. Nonetheless, Trump should be worried, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. The New York Attorney General has referred her findings to the IRS and the Federal Election Commission as potential violations of federal criminal law. Throughout his business and political careers, Trump has frequently bent or broken the rules. Since he arrived at the White House, the circus-like atmosphere of his presidency has cloaked evidence of his shamelessness and corruption from public scrutiny. But this lawsuit suggests that Trump cannot outrun them altogether. And just enough time for some short notes. This is actually a It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids piece that I heard about on the radio the other day. An intrepid raccoon became a social media sensation after it scaled the sheer concrete facade of a 25-story office tower in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota. The animal was first spotted by an employee of Minnesota Public Radio, MPR, on the 13th story of the UBS tower, who tweeted a photo of this creature outside his office window. Over the next 2 days, more workers posted pictures of the raccoon's death-defying ascent, and crowds cheered the critter from the street. After making it to the roof, the animal was caught in a humane trap and released in the woods. Can we please have a victory parade for hashtag MPR raccoon, one fan tweeted. And some short notes on the Talking Points page. Let's see. Wages paid to about 80% of American workers in manufacturing, construction, and non-supervisory service jobs actually fell over the past year when inflation is factored in. Rising gas prices, health care costs, and housing pushed the inflation rate up to 2.9%, while wages rose at 2.8%. The production of beef is responsible for roughly 6% of greenhouse gas emissions, making it the single biggest food contributor to climate change. Global beef demand is projected to double by 2050, driven by population growth in China and India. The annual crime rates of America's 30 largest cities fell by 2.1% in 2017, according to a new report by the Brennan Center for Justice. Violent crime dropped by 1%, and murders dropped by 3.4%. And we'll finish out the show today with a kind of a cheeky quote from Cher, quoted in the Providence, Rhode Island Journal. She says, "The trouble with some women is that they get all excited about nothing, and then they marry him." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138.